You are listening to Press Pass, brought to you by GNAT TV.
Hello and welcome back to another edition of Press Pass on GNAT TV. I'm Andrew McKeever, the news director at GNAT TV's news project, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today on Thursday, September 8th. It's also a great pleasure to be joined in our virtual studio by two distinguished journalists from our area here in Bennington County. It's great to have back on the program Susan Allen, who is the managing editor of the Bennington Banner, and Greg Sukenik, who is a reporter for Vermont News and Media, which publishes the Banner, the Manchester Journal, and the Brattleboro Reformer. Susan, Greg, great to have you back. Thanks for making the time for this conversation.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks as always, Andrew.
Well, it's now past Labor Day. We're wending our way towards the November elections after the August primaries, and we want to talk about that a little bit. But I thought before we jump into the political scene, let's talk about the start of school, which is for many folks an extremely big deal, parents and students alike. And Greg, you had an interesting story recently in the Banner about how the Southwest Vermont Supervisor Union is looking to fill a number of positions, teaching positions and staff positions. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on here? Is this an unusually high number of positions that are vacant, or is it kind of par for the course?
In Vermont, yes, as a whole. In Bennington County, not really. There are some positions in areas where typically there's difficulty hiring, bus drivers, paraprofessionals, and the like. But as far as teachers and administrators, the kinds of shortages we're seeing north of here in Vermont, what I was told was we're not seeing that here. That actually the BRSU and the SVSU were able to fill their positions. That despite the some of the difficulty that they reported in finding housing for folks. There's also some turnover at the heads of some of the independent schools here in the North Shire that we've been reporting on. There's a new head of school at Long Trail School and also a new head of school at Maple Street. We had a profile of the new head at Maple Street, whose name unfortunately escapes me at the moment. My apologies. I mean, we'll be doing the same at Long Trail as well. So it's always kind of an exciting time of year to, see kids back on the sidewalk, walking back and forth from Burr and Burton and crowding into Stewart's and hear the clack of pads again on the football field. It's good stuff.
You know, it's really interesting that the Bennington County schools aren't seeing what the rest of the state is seeing. The rest of the state is having trouble filling superintendent positions, filling principal positions. Greg mentioned paras and some of the staffing positions. And it's really tough to be a teacher right now because they can't find substitutes. So when three teachers are out with COVID, all the other healthy teachers have to sub for them. And that wears people out over the long haul. That really wears people out. And this is a really tough time to be in a school. One of the staffers from the school district was in my office the other day. And I said, do you have any idea why we've had luck filling the positions? And she said, she has no idea. No idea. We're just very, very lucky that we're not seeing what the rest of the state is seeing, which are really pronounced shortages.
It seems like there's two factors in play here. One is the often discussed housing situation around the state, where it just seems like there's just no housing available. And we've heard stories about schools recruiting teachers, well, businesses of all kinds, and employees wanting to come here and work, but they can't find a place to live. And I guess the other factor in play, I suppose, is COVID, right? The long running impact of that, the burnout factor or whatever. I guess I just wondered, are those the two main causes that we're seeing for that, or is there more to it than that?
I think maybe where we're getting lucky on housing is that we have housing markets to our south and our west, whereas maybe other parts of the state don't have that. Really don't have that luxury. I mean, it's hard to commute from Plattsburgh to Burlington. It's easy to drive from Hoosick Falls to Bennington or from North Adams to Bennington. So I think we've got that going for us. As far as COVID burnout,
that's COVID's just here. It is our new reality. Yeah. And I think schools are starting to reflect that. For example, starting on time this year, a lot of the mask mandates are gone. I think they're just saying, hey, it's like the flu. It's
right.
Here. We're just going to learn to live with it.
And interestingly, when I asked, you know, when we looked at the AOE and department health department's advice about, okay, here's how we're going to approach COVID this year. It's going to be pretty much like any other infectious disease. You don't have to test positive to come back. You do have to go home if you're feeling sick. We're still, you know, putting the nurses in charge of most of this stuff. There, I was expecting that there might be some pushback. There was no pushback at all from any school administrators I talked to. They're like, they very much see this the same way that Daniel French sees this. It's like, look, we're getting into endemic stage now, and we've got to figure out a way to live with it. So for better or for worse, here we are.
Well, before we leave the education front, Susan, I wanted to ask you about another story you guys had in the banner a couple of days ago about Michael Lawler, who is the head of it used to be called the Career Development Center, now the Southwest Vermont Tech.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who sounds like he's going to be doing that job in a rather interesting way. Can you tell us more about that?
This is an interesting story. Mike's been with the district for 22 years. He's sort of been the superintendent of the district for 10 years. He's very well thought of. And for family reasons, he's had to move to California. And the school board in June said, okay, let's do your job remotely. You need to be in Vermont 10 days every month, but let's give it a try. And he's going to pay for his travel. It's extremely unusual. And you know, I thought there might be a little bit of a backlash against it, but so far things have been fairly quiet from the public. They're going to review the situation in January and then officially sort of work on it in June to make sure it's working. And this reflects back on the conversation we just had. The board decided they had a great superintendent, and there aren't many superintendents on the market. They would really have to scratch their heads and search. And, you know, with the technology in place, thanks to COVID, we're a little more experienced with dealing with sort of this hybrid work in person and via Zoom format. And they also think he's a great superintendent. They don't want to lose him. So we will know in January, unless there's something dramatic that happens between now and then, when they go back and say, how is this working? Is this working for us? Is it not working for us? And then in June, when his contract comes up, it'll be a more serious discussion. But it's an interesting approach. I think most of your viewers know that our sheriff has spent much of the past year in Tennessee, not in Vermont. And so there have been a few cracks about that. I don't think people are as comfortable or happy about that. But so far with Lawler, there hasn't been a big stink. That may come, but it hasn't yet.
Well, it's certainly interesting because I think the technical education has gotten a lot more attention in the last couple of years as we've seen, you know, shortages of carpenters, plumbers, electricians, and everything else, and that operation there certainly is primed to kind of be an important player in helping fill those kinds of jobs for students who want to go into those fields. And
Andrew, it's a great program. It's a great school, and it has great programs. And there are a couple of people on the ground, the assistant superintendent. There are some folks on the ground in person who can sort of back up Mike Lawler in his absence. And we just have our fingers crossed that it continues on the track it's on, because for a lot of people, this is the future. And the state and the federal government's putting a lot of money into technical education, and we're hoping for the best for this school.
Right. Well, let's leave it there for the moment and pivot over to the political scene here. Sort of Labor Day is usually considered the unofficial start of the formal campaign season, and things have sort of clarified a little bit. Greg, let me start with you on this part of it. We do have all of a sudden a competitive race of sorts, I guess you could say, in the Bennington 4 district. That includes the towns of Manchester, Arlington, Sandgate, and a part of Sunderland, with the arrival of a candidate on the Republican side, Joe Jervis, resident of Arlington, who won as a write-in in the August 9th primary. So he'll be facing off against the two Democrat incumbents, Kathleen James and Seth Bongartz. You had a profile piece about Mr. Jervis in a recent edition of the Banner. What was your takeaway from him?
Here we are. And yet again, we have a three-way race in the Bennington 4. It doesn't seem like we're never going to. It's a seat that draws competitors for sure. Joe is, I would say, he's an earnest guy, and he truly does believe what he's putting forward. There's no hiding sort of where his allegiances are as a Republican. He's, you know, and if you look at his some of the links from his website, it's pretty clear that he's aligned with the former president. It seems like he's he has some family reasons, some instances where he felt there was government overreach, and it sort of got him to interested in politics again. He had run for the Arlington Select Board seat that was held by Cynthia Browning at town meeting. Cynthia won re-election. So, but he decided to give it another shot. Seems very interested in election integrity and in education and curriculum and parent involvement in that. Lots of sort of a number of issues that have kind of been hot button issues for folks who are Trump aligned in the Republican Party. Now he's going up against two Democrats who did very well in the last election and have in Kathleen James's case has gained some seniority as two or three terms in. She's now an assistant majority leader. Seth Bongartz, well known throughout the community, a former legislator who's just completed his first term back and is in their Natural Resources Committee, and the two of them did work on housing. So probably a bit of an uphill fight for Mr. Jervis, but we'll see where things go.
It's interesting, and we'll talk about this more with the statewide races in a moment. But he is sort of reflective of this. Knocking heads the Republican Party is having with itself at the moment. There are the MAGA Republicans, and there are the moderate Republicans. And I would definitely put Joe more in the MAGA camp. And for many of us who've been watching politics for a long time, this is unusual in Vermont for the Republican Party to swing right. So I was interested to read the story about Joe and see. Not only on the state level is the party sort of struggling with its conservative versus moderates, but in some of the local races too.
Yeah, it is. It certainly is a change of pace from the Republican Party of let's say Jim Douglas and Phil Scott, for that matter, where it seems like the statewide party as an organization, it definitely seems to be much more to the right than I remember it being, I guess, anyway,
right.
At best. But it'll be interesting to see how much appeal Mr. Jervis's platform has for area voters here. Before we leave the North Shire, Greg, one other quick race we've got going on just to the north of here, up in Dorset and Danby, in that district, Bennington Rutland 1, I believe it's called. I think it also includes Mount Tabor, Landgrove, and Peru. We have Mike Rice, a young man, an organic farmer, I believe, running against William Giotti. He's a resident, I think, of Mount Tabor, who was mm-hmm. been a lifelong resident, as far as I know. Any thoughts there on that race? Is that
it looks? Like, I think that's going to be a really interesting race, Andrew, and I'll tell you why. Mike, he's come out of the gate with a fair amount of energy. He's got sort of the progressive coalition behind him. I think he had David Zuckerman visiting this past weekend, if memory serves. But William Giotti, I mean, that is a very well-known name. His father was here on the police force in Manchester in the 1970s, died in the line of duty as a liquor control board inspector. He's been a police officer. He's worked at two or three of the area golf courses. He's well known, and so I think that sort of over for that seems like it's a really sort of wide open contest. I mean, it tends to be a more sort of Republican leaning, if you will. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly the incumbent Linda Joy Sullivan is a Democrat, but also a Democrat who wasn't afraid to veer away from the party line in financial matters. So I think that's going to be that should be a very interesting race. And I would bet probably kind of close.
And to your point about it being a Republican leaning district, of course, Linda Joy Sullivan's predecessor was Patty Comline, who was a Republican, minority leader. And then before that was Walter Freed, who was the last Republican House Speaker.
Yes, I was about to say that.
Really go way back.
Yeah.
History class.
We're gonna take us all the way back.
Well, anyway, Susan, back to you now. Let's talk a little bit about the county sheriff's race. I mean, that's the other kind of hot political race. I guess you could call it a competitive race. We have the same three candidates who ran in the primary. James Gulley, they ran in the Democrat primary, all as Democrats, I assume. And James Gulley was the winner of that primary by quite a wide margin. And then Lieutenant Joel Howard is a member of the current member of the county sheriff's force, decided to run as a Republican. And then Bo Alexander, the third place finisher out of the three, opted back in as an independent.
You know, pre-primary, I would have said that this is a super close race, but I feel like we've sort of had a trial run, and it was surprisingly not a close race. Gulley won by a good, comfortable margin. The other two have, Joel Howard's going to run as a Republican. He didn't take the loss and say good luck and walk away. He's going to stay in, and Bo Alexander as an independent is going to stay in, so it'll be a repeat in November. I think the voters spoke pretty clearly in the primary, unless something dramatic happens or I'm missing something out there. This is not uncommon in the sheriff's race. It's happened before where the loser in the primary stays in and tries again in November. One complicating factor might be that Lieutenant Howard's son was recently in the media, including today. He pled guilty to misdemeanor domestic assault and allegedly threatened the victim with his father's position, saying, you know, if she tried to take this further, she might face some danger to herself. And Lieutenant Howard immediately has sort of distanced himself from the comments. He's assured everybody that there's nothing to worry about. He would, of course, never do that in his job. Whether that becomes a factor for him or not, I have no idea. That's the only change I've seen since the primary. It might just be a redo. And I mean, voters are unpredictable, but Gulley had a pretty solid showing in the primary. So we'll see.
Yeah, well, never a dull moment, I guess. Well, let's turn to the statewide scene just for a moment or two here. We've got four races that are kind of interesting with statewide impact here. Obviously, we start with the governor's race, Governor Scott versus Brenda Siegel, who ran for lieutenant governor 2 years ago and lost in the Democratic primary then. I assume the conventional wisdom there is that this is Governor Scott's race to lose. I mean, that Brenda Siegel is not very well known, and Governor Scott seems to be continuing to enjoy very high popularity ratings. And I guess it'll be, to me, it's going to be interesting to see just how extensively the governor actually campaigns. I mean, he and his staff might think, you know what, if we just kind of, stay calm and carry on, everything will take care of itself.
Stay calm and carry on is his modus operandi. And he's got, 70% popularity rating, which is unheard of. Brenda Siegel's made a lot of noise, though, on the homeless issue, including camping out at the State House steps for more than 20 nights. And she did change the governor's position on a particular homeless program for the better for the homeless community. I have a feeling that he is solid. And for another funny reason, Vermonters don't like to pack one party in every the legislature Democrat, the both congressional seats Democratic. They sort of like some balance in government. So having a Republican in some position might persuade some folks to also vote for him. I've thought about that for Lieutenant Governor Benning, candidate Benning, that, you know, he might hurt a little bit because Phil Scott, a Republican, is in a big position. That's a minor point, but sometimes we Vermonters like to have at the top more than one party in power. So I think that also helps Governor Scott a little bit.
Well, Brenda has added some Sinead Clifford to her staff. She's got some progressive momentum behind her. I think certainly folks are sort of feeling or saying that they're energized after the primary. And certainly the latest wrinkle in the home, the homeless program, or the some of the couple of the programs that were federally funded winding down. I mean, that might give her, you know, some momentum, but it's a steep cliff to climb for her. And, you know, it's a governor with a 70% favorability rating. That's a tough hill to climb for a challenger.
That's Everest.
Not one.
That's Everest.
Yes, it is.
But you never know. I mean, yeah. You just never know in Vermont.
I mean, you were here for Scott Mill and Peter Shumlin. So, I mean, I wasn't. So, I mean, I don't think people saw that one coming necessarily.
Right.
The circumstances are different for every election.
Right. And that housing question is going to be a big one. And certainly something that Brenda Siegel has identified with very strongly.
Yes.
Well, let's move on to the lieutenant governor race, which to me is kind of one of the potentially really more interesting races of all of them. Since if you think that maybe typically governors hang around for, let's say, four terms, which would be the case if Phil Scott wins this year, the person who's in the lieutenant governor's position is in a really strong position to run for the governorship in 2 years. And so this year we've got David Zuckerman returning to seek his old job back. He was lieutenant governor until 2020 when he ran against Phil Scott and lost by a pretty wide margin. And his Republican opponent this year is Joseph Benning, a state senator from Caledonia County, who I think could be described as sort of a moderate Republican or a non-MAGA Republican or whatever. Any thoughts on that race? It strikes me as that could be a fairly close one.
I'm not sure. It's the closest I see on paper anyway. Both Greg and I have covered these both men kind of extensively in their state house lives. And I will say they are both decent people. They are they've treated each other with decency. I can't see this, I hope, turning into a negative kind of campaign. They both campaigned positively. I know that in the past when Zuckerman has run for lieutenant governor, which an office he held for 4 years, a lot of people didn't even know who he was other than he's that farmer with the ponytail.
And he cut off the ponytail.
Really, it was quite an image. I mean, people felt very strongly that in support of him, the farmer with the ponytail. And Joe Benning is very different. He's an attorney. He's from the Northeast Kingdom. As you say, he's moderate. He's a very moderate Republican in the ilk of Phil Scott. He's been endorsed by the governor. He's been endorsed by former Governor Douglas. On paper, to me, that looks like the closest of the races I'm looking at. But he's not, Joe Benning is not a farmer with a ponytail, and he doesn't have quite the name recognition. So
He
does have a motorcycle.
Right.
But I suspect that's going to be a issues-based campaign, not mudslinging. They are nice people, and I think will run nice campaigns.
I think the one thing possibly working for Benning is he does have some statewide recognition as having been minority leader for some time in the Senate. He does ride a motorcycle, and he is in the sort of the moderate camp. And I think some folks might, you know, look at Zuckerman and think, well, you know, you had your statewide, your run at the governor's seat, and it was a Democratic year, and the incumbent took two out of every three votes. What are you doing here? But people, Zuckerman, David Zuckerman does have, his supporters are very strong supporters. Look at the money he raised for his run for governor in the last general election. So I think I see it. I'm with you in this, Sue. I think it's close. I still think it's probably, I would probably still see Zuckerman in the lead because he has just the, that strong base and that extra name recognition and having been the farmer with the ponytail. I have a friend who's a union organizer in Massachusetts, met him once and, you know, wrote back to me and raves like, I love your lieutenant governor. He has a ponytail. True story. So,
and just one other small note on, on Joe Benning is, I'm sure the Republicans are watching what's their bench. When Governor Scott steps away, who's their bench? And for much of the Republican Party, Joe Benning would be a nice moderate next guy to go for it, as opposed to some of the more conservative Republicans bursting on the scene and sort of reflecting the entire party in Vermont.
Yes, John Klar, he's not.
No, no, not at all. Well, let's move on quickly here. Just, I don't know if there's much to say that's new about the races for the U.S. Senate, where we have Peter Welch, the congressman, hoping to move up to retiring Senator Pat Leahy's seat. He's in a contest with Gerald Malloy, a political newcomer on the Republican side. Gerald Malloy, unlike, let's say, Joe Benning, does seem to be sort of more of a skew to the right-wing side of the Republican Party, at least to the extent I've heard him speak. But I think there, boy, that would be an upset of all upsets if Peter Welch lost that race, given his name recognition.
It would be. And it's Deploy Malloy, who, you know, he has a very conservative platform. He wished he had been at the January 6th Capitol protest to protest, to be clear. He hasn't said he'd want to break into the Capitol, but he wished he'd been there. In Vermont, I think that's going to be a tough message.
I think, you know, when we look back at the primary, we look at, you know, Molly Gray had the statewide recognition and, you know, how is it that she sort of, you know, lost to a, you know, to Becca Ballant. But I think the bigger question is, you know, how did Christina Nolan, who had the sort of the name recognition and was, you know, how did she lose to Gerald Malloy, you know, whose signs mostly I saw have seen on public property until recently. And usually that's kind of a sign of someone who's, you know, who might be a little out of their depth, but there he is as the nominee. And it would be a major upset if he won, but he's certainly going to make the debates interesting. He's a true believer. Very much opposed to the to Prop 5, to the to the Reproductive Liberty Amendment. He's a abortion ban, no exceptions kind of guy. So I don't know how that plays in Vermont. We'll see.
Yeah, that will be interesting because it certainly seems like over the past couple of months, especially since the Dobbs decision was handed down from the Supreme Court in June, that that abortion question has been a real animating factor and game changer almost on a nationwide basis. You know, hearing reports of voter registration among women skyrocketing and that issue all of a sudden galvanizing a lot of people who might be sort of independent, middle of the road types, going, hey, wait a minute, you know, this actually happened. And therefore, articles like the one that's going to be on the ballot in November here, Article 22, might bring many more voters out of the polls than we've seen in the past. And just to finish up here in Congress, we've got State Senator Becca Ballant running against Liam Madden, who's sort of a Republican, but not really. I don't know. It's hard to kind of figure. He describes himself as an independent, but won the Republican primary, but then was disowned, it seemed like, by the Republicans. They're not going to be supporting him financially. Certainly kind of like something, a what? And then we have Eric Redick, who ran in the Republican primary, came in second to Madden, and is now going to be on the ballot as a Libertarian. She definitely is much more, at least from the conversation I had with her, struck me as someone again, kind of skewing to the right there. What do we make of this race? This is good theater anyway.
One point on Reddick. She's not going quietly. I'm getting a lot of emails to the newsroom email box with her positions on issues. So she's definitely taking it seriously and going to work for it. But I think this is a very exciting race with, you know, will this be the year that Vermont sends the first woman? Will this be the first year that Vermont sends an openly gay member to Congress? You know, she's a Southern Vermonter, so that's really great for us to have one of our neighbors going to Washington and fighting for funding, because, you know, Southern Vermont often seems to get overlooked in things. And so this is another one of those, when you look at on paper, you will anticipate that Becca Balint will do very, very well and take that seat. It'll be an interesting, there, you know, with two opponents in there coming after, that should be an interesting dialogue. It'll force her to come out on lots of issues, which I think she would anyway. But again, I think it's sort of hers to lose. And it would, if she wins, I think that's going to be a real boon for a lot of people who care about issues, important yes. issues.
Liam Madden is he's a fascinating story, how he winds up on the Republican ballot, his background. His being a veteran, his involvement in a veterans organization, opposed to, and Erica Reddick is also, I mean, she's got a sense of humor and she's not afraid to use it. She's got a fascinating story as well as being a person in recovery. So I think it's going to be entertaining. I would have to agree with Sue. I think this is Becca Balint. I think she, on paper, she's a prohibitive favorite.
Indeed. It's hard to picture her losing unless she makes a major stumble of some sort or another, and that's hard to imagine. Well, let's leave the political scene then for now, and I'm sure there'll be much more to talk about over the next couple of, and write about as well over the next couple of months. And just as we kind of work our way towards the end here, Greg. Two big stories out of the North Shore you've been reporting on, the departure of John O'Keefe from the town manager position of Manchester. He's taken a job down at Williams College in their athletic department, and also the new Lincoln Hall that's been proposed for Hildene. It'll be quite an addition to that that facility there. John O'Keefe was the town manager for, let me think if I can do my math right, almost 15 years. I remember when he was first introduced to us back in January of 2007 at the town hall there, and going and covering that story. He had quite an interesting run there as the town manager.
You know, it was he caught me by surprise with that one, because that's actually the day he resigned was the day he had COVID. That was a day that I was like out sick with COVID. I won't let him live that down. But anyway, he's quite the tenure. When you look at getting the roundabout finished, getting the town through Irene, helping the town sort of transition from its sort of place as a retail hub into more of a more diverse tourism economy. I think probably if you look back at it and decide, okay, well, what's John O'Keefe's legacy here? Because the roundabout had been in plans for a while before he finally sort of got it across the finish line. I think when you look at Dana Thompson Memorial Park and you look at the soccer tournament that's going to be happening the weekend after this is being taped, you look at the skate park, which is going to double in size. You look at the playing fields that are sort of that, near Applejack, that were essentially just rocks and weeds that, you know, before he physically helped lay them out. If you just sort of look at all the recreation program. I mean, he's, you know, he told me that, you know, if you go to towns, you look around, you don't see a lot of towns that are struggling that have great parks, and you don't see great towns with lousy parks. Usually the two things really go together. And you put that sort of together with his ability to keep Manchester's finances on a pretty solid path. I think he's got himself a legacy. The second thing about that is that Leslie Parra steps in as interim, and she's got experience. And when you look at the team that's sort of put together in town hall, the select board says they feel like they can, members of the select board tell me they feel like they've got time to really do a deliberate search. And I think that's kind of a credit to him as well, that he was able to put that team together and put Manchester in position. That said, there's still a lot to do. So there's still challenges ahead, with Leslie at the helm, or with a successor who could be Leslie or someone else at the helm. So we'll see.
Yeah, and the timing is kind of interesting because it's only September, and March town meeting is a long way away. But these searches can take a while, and particularly as we've been talking about with the housing thing, it's not necessarily a slam dunk they're going to find a place to live, and all of a sudden, you know, it could be January before they announce somebody, and then it's like bang, right into budget and town meeting, and someone who might be coming in from outside and not too familiar with some of the local issues will definitely spend a lot of late nights doing the homework. And then, of course, we have this new Lincoln Hall proposal here for Hildene. That will be quite a change. That's a fairly big building that they're planning on building there to replace the outdoor tent.
Yeah, I had an opportunity to sort of walk the grounds with Brian Keith and Nan Bambara and with Isabel Wisner, our photographer, and get a sense of what they're planning. It's kind of hard to hide 14,000 square feet, but they've managed to sort of put the design together where it's, you know, try to have the profile be a little sort of less obvious than the tent that's there now. And it would give them the opportunity to do more programming, to have a permanent site for the weddings that bring Hildene a good part of its operating income, and also some food service. So when they have visitors come there, I'm just talking to Brian about this, Brian Keefe, the president of Hildene, they would get visitors who would get to the door and they realized that Hildene actually was more than just a house, that there's a lot to see there and experience there. And then they have to sort of weigh that out against, well, the kids are hungry. So folks would say, well, we'll come back, and they'd go to town, and then they wouldn't come back. So having food service on the grounds, you know, that is an advantage for Hildene. That would present an advantage for Hildene to be able to retain guests for longer and sort of be able to expand the experience and get across more about what the Lincoln family's legacy is here in the North Shire. It's an ambitious undertaking, but it seems like it's a really important one to their mission and to their long-term success.
So the other big news item here I think is going to be kind of interesting, well, across the entire county, Bennington, from Bennington to Manchester and beyond, is the upcoming arrival of legal sales of cannabis, October 1st. Do we have any sense that there are going to be a couple of stores opening somewhere around the county on that, or any applications in the works, or what do we know?
Get away, Greg.
Okay. Yeah, we've got at least one. I was at the Development Review Board meeting on Wednesday night. And the business, which is presently I'm suddenly blanked on the name. Oh, this is embarrassing. So there's a CBD store on Depot Street. And let me see if I can
Bonnie's.
Aunt Bonnie's, thank you. Mm-hmm. Aunt Bonnie's, thank you very much, Sue.
No, I blanked on it too, Greg, so don't feel bad.
Hard to miss but the owners of Aunt Bonnie's they're going to pivot and move more towards THC as well as the active ingredient in cannabis, as well as CBD products that they've been selling at that location. Now the DRB heard the application, closed the meeting. They've got 30 to 45, they have 45 days by statute to make a decision. But if you were sort of reading the tea leaves, there wasn't a whole lot of, you might expect that there would be sort of a lot of pointed questions but it seemed like, just trying to read the tea leaves, it seemed like the business had its I's dotted and its T's crossed. If if approval moves forward, then they would then move on to the to dealing with the State Cannabis Control Board. Whether this all gets done by October 1st, it's hard to know because the state does have a backlog of applications. There's also concerns about financing. In the case of Aunt Bonnie's, they were fortunate enough, or you know, to be able to work with VESCU, the credit union. Now you have to have sort of a state chartered institution to do this work, to do this business, because marijuana is still a federally prohibited substance, and so you can't use a federally chartered bank. And it turns out the state doesn't take cash for tax payments, but they still want their tax payments. So, so the proprietor of Aunt Bonnie was able to work with the credit union. So they're on their way, at least it seems. And maybe they'll be the folks who get across the finish line first. We'll see. But I would bet that we'll have it. You know, we're going to have at least one cannabis store opening here in the fall here in Manchester. It seems like things are moving in the right direction, though obviously that's the DRB's decision to make.
And is there some sense that this is going to be like sort of a new revenue source? I know in other towns where they talked about, you know, whether or not, you know, we want to have that in the first place, because towns could opt in or opt out. One of the big arguments was, well, you know, we'll be able to, you know, impose a sales and use tax on that, and it'll be a new revenue stream for the town to help, you know, balance the budget or whatever. I haven't heard much conversation, though, at least locally, about that. I mean, one would think that that would be kind of a big yay or nay factor around it.
What was the sales pitch, for sure, when folks were trying to say, hey, we should allow sales here in Manchester because we have this 1% local option tax? But Massachusetts, neighboring state, legal. New York State, moving in that direction. So I think the idea that this is going to be like the opening days of Massachusetts's legal market, or, you know, that's probably not going to happen. And it certainly won't be Colorado. It won't be sort of a cannabis bonanza, if you will. But that 70% of 1% that's money. That's an advantage for Manchester that it has pressed in order to try to keep taxes lower. And that's there.
It's also a draw to the downtown. People will come. They're not going to be in every single town. They're going to be spread out. I know there's a rumor that Bennington is going to get one as well, or a business is eyeing a place in Bennington. So people are going to come for that to your downtown. And while they're there, they're going to grocery shop and they're going to eat at a restaurant and they're going to, you know, stop by the stores and buy things. So I'm sure towns do see that as a bit of an economic boom in that sense.
Well, we will have to wait and see, as the saying goes, as to how that plays out. But it certainly will be an interesting, another interesting story to follow. Well, we have a few minutes left, Susan, and I thought I wanted to go to you to sort of help close things out here today, because I'm not sure if celebrating is the right word, your one-year anniversary, or almost, I think it was.
Coming up on it.
Yeah, October or something or another last year, yeah. When you arrived as the managing editor of the Banner, after a very distinguished career in journalism across the state. After 1 year, what are some thoughts and reflections on Bennington and the way journalism is done now compared to, you know, past years?
I would say my biggest comment about Bennington is it's a town that in many ways was ahead of its time. Bennington, when I came 5 years ago or 10 years ago, had empty storefronts and felt a little back on its heels. And it is taking off. Bennington has new businesses, restaurants, music, arts, theater, things for families to do, recreation. Every Thursday night, there's an outdoor concert all summer long, and the whole community practically comes out and celebrates. It is a fabulous place to live, and it is on the upswing. At the same time, in the last year since I've been here, we have seen the drug situation worsened dramatically. We've seen gangs move into certain streets in Bennington, not everywhere, but certain streets in Bennington. The police have been doing very public raids and trying to get crime under control to keep Bennington a fabulous town. But the reason I say they're ahead of their time is Bennington owned up to it. The police did make the raids. We put it on the front page of the paper. People acknowledge we had the problem. And only in the last month or so have I noticed Burlington's got a bigger problem than we do. And they're just now starting to own up to it. Springfield, Vermont, just north of us and to the east, they've got a tremendous drug problem and a gang problem. And they're just starting to own up to us. So I'm really proud in the year I've been there that Bennington kind of stepped up and said, we're growing and we love it. We have a problem and we're going to fix it. And I feel like we're a little bit ahead of the rest of the state seems to be discovering their problems later than we did and are coming right along behind us to try to find solutions. So that's sort of a big picture thing. Little picture is just journalism in general. I have been so surprised at the community support for the Bennington Banner. All year long, people have weighed in with me on what they like about it. They're very free telling me what they don't like about it. If I make a mistake, I hear about it. And thank you, people. I really do want to hear that. They love their local paper and they don't want it to fail. And they give me all kinds of input and they hang in with us when we had trouble with our delivery system with the U.S. Postal Service. They stayed with us and they're signing up for our online and they're sending letters to the editor. And I have been pleasantly surprised. The advertisers have reached out to us and, you know, we wanted to do a high school page with the local high school, Mount Anthony, and a business sponsored it for us. They stepped forward and paid for it. I mean, it's a community that loves journalism and loves its local paper, feels perfectly comfortable telling us when we're good and when we stink. And yay for that. I'm just thrilled. I'm looking so forward to another year and taking it even further.
All right. Well, that's great to hear. I mean, because certainly local journalism, as I've read and studied about it, I mean, it's more trusted, it seems like, than the national media. It's interesting, but we've seen across the country national media, you know, newsrooms losing reporters, and I guess with all the political polarization going on, you know, there's less trust in what they're saying. Whereas small local papers like the Banner, the Journal, Reformer have retained that.
And just a quick point, I'm going to make a plug for Greg. Greg lives in Manchester. He shops in Manchester. His kid went to school there. He's known in the community. People know the Bennington Banner staff and the Journal staff and feel, you know, appreciate that local connection. They call him with tips all the time for two reasons. They trust him as a journalist and they also want to see it in their local paper. So, you know, it's not just the Banner, it's the Journal as well. And yay for Greg.
Oh, thank you. I have to say, it's been great working with Sue as my editor, and I will send you a 1-year anniversary gift. It'll be a 50-inch story without photos at 6 p.m. No,
right
I won't
on that
actually
line.
Do that.
Yeah. Yes. All right.
We miss you, Andrew. You need to come back.
Oh, I have fond memories of both places. Well, I guess we're going to have to leave it there for today. Unfortunately, this has been a really fascinating and enjoyable conversation. I want to thank Susan Allen, the managing editor of the Bennington Banner, and Greg Sukenik, reports for the Banner, the Journal, and the Brattleboro Reformer, for being with us and bringing us up to speed on all the major stories that are happening here in our neck of the woods. And I want to thank also you, our viewers, for being with us. I hope you found our program interesting today, and well, we'll see you again the next time. Meanwhile, have a great day, and take care.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.